I am Patrick Yost, National President of Fraternal Order Police. This is the Blue View. Well, Representative Spanberger, thank you. Thank you for joining us. But more importantly, let me just start by saying, you know, for 40 years, we've been fighting with Social Security, windfall elimination, government pension offset. It's an injustice to public employees. And we've really focused our energy over the last last two Congresses, to try and get to a point where we can effect some change that adversely affects public employees. And you have been such a star yourself, and Representative Graves have been absolute staunch supporters of this. And we would not be where we are today if it would not be for the advocacy and the efforts of yourself and Representative Graves. So thank you on behalf of the hardworking men and women who suit up and show up every day in communities across this country that know that you're fighting for us to protect the benefit that we have earned but we can't receive. So, again, thank you for joining us. For some of our members who may not know who you are, they might have seen some of our previous previous podcasts. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. My name is Abigail Spanberger, and I represent Virginia's 7th District in Congress. I was elected back in 2018 and reelected in each subsequent election. My background is also one of public service. I began my career as a federal agent. But I'm also the daughter of a career federal agent as well. So public service is a proud tradition in my family, and it's one of the reasons why I've been so focused on the issue of the WEP and GPO and the kind of unfair nature of the way that they very unfairly and we use that word a lot when talking about this bill and also the provisions WEP and GPO, because that's exactly what they are. They are unfair provisions within Social Security that negatively impact people. And so since I first got to Congress, I've been focused on repealing these two elements from Social Security and eliminating those unfair provisions that so negatively impact those who chose to devote themselves to public service, be they retired law enforcement, retired teachers, retired firefighters. You know, the list goes on and on of those who are impacted. And we are closer than ever in getting this done.
Yeah. So for the any of our viewers and listeners that are not familiar with windfall elimination, government pension offset, is, and what it is and how it affects public employees, if I could, and you chime right in if you'd like to add a little bit to it, if you're a public employee, the Social Security system was designed at some point to where public employees were exempt from having to pay into the Social Security system. However, if someone who worked through worked and did their time in public service and went on and paid their points into the Social Security system, just like every other American, and eligible for a benefit, commensurate with the amount that they paid into the system, they, if they were in private sector, even if they paid in a 401k, they would be able to receive their benefit. But because public employees receive a public pension of which we paid for, of which we have contributed to, somehow the 40 years ago in 1983, a decision was made that in order to shore up the Social Security system, they were going to take as much as 60% of the benefit away from public employees. And it's just not fair. We were required to pay the same amount as every other American, yet we do not receive the same amount. And I'll go a step further. We need to repeal the steal. The reality is that if this scheme was managed, was undertaken by a money manager or a pension system, we would charge them with embezzlement. Another law that Congress passed in 1895 in protection of a person's employment rights. So here we are, their employment benefits. So here we are, find ourselves by simply changing a name and taking away and stealing money as much as 60% of a hard-earned benefit that public employees are the only ones that are affected by this decision in this action by Congress, or by giving authority to IRS to be able to take these funds from us, or Social Security system, take these funds from us. Anything you'd like to add to that?
I mean, I agree with everything you said so far. I would just add that, sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, it's meant to prevent double dipping. Well, there's no double dipping, because if you've paid into a pension system and you've paid into Social Security, why would one not be able to receive the earned benefits for the systems that they had paid into? It is not the case that this is a discussion about people who paid into a pension system, never paid a dime into Social Security, and are now looking for benefits that they didn't, you know, earn or pay into. And so there's some pretty strong misunderstandings and some rhetoric around this. And, you know, among the other critiques that one might hear is, oh, well, Social Security is in trouble. And if we were to pass this bill that, you know, that brings that date of its long-term solvency closer to us. The reality is the estimates on that are, you know, it varies. It does make us have to face the overall issue of how to have Social Security be solvent long into the future. But Congress's failure to address the challenges within the larger Social Security program does not justify taking earned benefits and sort of punting what is a requirement that we address, kind of the long term, how to make Social Security work, you know, decades, generations into the future. We can't sort of delay that conversation by a couple months or a year by negatively impacting and unfairly burdening retired federal employees. And so many of the constituents who I represent, and this is a really relevant issue on the ground in Virginia, you know, there's reductions in what they would otherwise receive via Social Security, in some cases $400 a month. Yeah. And if you are a retiree who has spent your career in public service, and you assume, because that's always been the discussion, that if you pay into Social Security, you know, what your earned benefit is will be there upon your retirement. There are a lot of people who have had a pretty rude and negative awakening when they do in fact retire and realize those benefits that they had earned, those benefits that their neighbor down the street who never pursued a career in public service is getting, is now not available to them. And I hear about this issue all the time from constituents. And just as a little bit of a little moment of levity, if I may, you know, sometimes I do call out telephone town halls. I have a very large geographic district. And rather than making, you know, people travel 2 hours to see me, we do a lot of call out town halls where we call out to people so they know what's happening. People also call into us. And at every single town hall, I have somebody asking a question about, well, there's this problem called the windfall elimination provision, or I'm a retired federal employee. And it got to the point where I did double check with my team, like, that's not a plant, right? This is a real person, because every month I have somebody else ask about it. And sometimes it's, hey, I know you're working on it, what's the progress? But it is such an important issue. And the reason we've been able to garner so much support in Congress, and I know we'll get to this in the conversation, Pat, the reason we've been able to garner so much support is because once people learn about it, the inherent lack of fairness is very, very clear. And so once people understand how it impacts their constituents, or their fellow Americans, we have had tremendous success in getting people to sign on as co-sponsors. And we just need to move that from co-sponsors to people who vote on it, and you know, move it to the Senate and then move it to the president's desk.
Yeah, you mentioned about the amount of feedback that you receive in this one issue. You know, it's some pretty extraordinary times for law enforcement. Yeah. We've been through a lot in the last 4 years, and we've seen, you know, just a lot of discussion, you know, in the evolution of law enforcement. And he's, you know, he's passed 4 years. But I will tell you this, you know, even at the height of some of the most difficult times we had over these past 4 years, without a doubt, the calls I would receive from our members who are affected by windfall elimination, government pension offset, by far outpaced everything else. I mean, I remember the world was on fire. We had riots everywhere. And I had members saying, look, that's all important, but what's important right now is how I pay for my utility bill, or how I pay for my medicine, or how I pay for food. I retired at a pension of which I paid into, and now I am, you know, I'm Social Security. I paid into that. I'm entitled to a benefit, but I'm not getting that benefit, yet other people are receiving their benefit. What's the difference between me paying into a pension system, a public pension system, and someone else paying into a 401k? They get to keep their revenue, that they, you know, their benefits that they've earned, but I don't get to keep mine. You know, interesting thing, you know, the big question has always been, where does the money come from? You know, how do we fix this? And I don't think there's a person in Washington will agree that this is not egregious and needs to be fixed. The problem becomes, how do we fix it without causing an economic impact to the system? Yeah. But I'd like to argue that point. And the way I'll argue it is this. I've been stealing money from public employees for 40 years. Yeah. Not asking you to pay it all back. What I am saying is that you need to recognize that the money that you're talking about that you think is shoring up the Social Security system is being stolen. And Congress passed a law in 1895 to prevent that from happening. I mean, yeah, 1895, to prevent that from happening. So to suggest that in order to be able to repeal this, the people who are being stolen from need to tell you where to find the money? Well, I'm going to tell you what that is. That's being a victim and being told that if you got to find a way to pay the restitution before we'll give you your money. Yep. And that just doesn't make any sense. You're telling me I got to find somewhere to get money to pay for what you're stealing from us. That's so illogical. So I say all that. Look, I wanted to set this up because if someone's watching and they don't quite understand what windfall elimination is, now I think they have an understanding. In the simplest terms, I stand in line and a person in front of me works in the private sector and they buy a loaf of bread and they pay for that loaf of bread. They walk out with that loaf of bread. But when I walk up to the counter, they say, oh, you're a public employee. They take 60% of the loaf away and charge me the same price. And that's the easiest way to explain what's happening here. My only sin, or the only sin of those people who are affected by it, is they chose a life of public service. They followed a servant heart and have been penalized for it. So right. Enough of that. The important thing is where we are today. You know, let's talk about the 290 rule. Let's talk about the consensus calendar. Let's talk about where we are, what we need to do. And again, this is the closest we've ever been. As you said, we've got an opportunity to affect some real change here and fix an injustice that's happened for four decades. It's time for Congress to fix it today. But let's talk about how we got to this point and what we need to do to move forward.
So we have a bill in Congress. I lead it with Garrett Graves, Republican from Louisiana, and we have done the really fun and rewarding work, and I thank FOP and all of the other advocacy groups that have been engaging on this issue, but we've partnered on the really rewarding work of making sure our colleagues know what egregious elements of the law, the WEP and the GPO are. And we've engaged people on the notion that the way to address this theft, which I really appreciate the way you described it, is to repeal these two provisions, right? And notably, what I find so spectacular about the people who advocate on this issue is it is, for some people, years and years and years of lost Social Security earned benefits. And people are saying, we just want you to fix it. We just want you to fix it moving forward. I want to make sure that, you know, my neighbor down the street doesn't face what I've faced. I want to make sure that, you know, the other retirees aren't worried about how they're going to pay their mortgage in retirement. And so I think there's something so awe-inspiring. You mentioned the kind of issue of restitution. People are just saying, just stop doing this. Stop taking these funds from our Social Security, from our earned benefits. Just stop it. We don't have to talk about the past. You know, I think people are just focused on fixing it into the future. And so when we have talked to our colleagues, Garrett and I have been able to get 325 members of Congress to co-sponsor this legislation. And for anybody who follows the news even a little bit, they know that at times Capitol Hill can be a bit of a contentious place. And so, and I think this is an important point to make, it isn't just that somebody say, oh yeah, I support that bill, or when it comes up for a vote, I'll vote for it. These are literally people who are willing to put their name on a bill, whether it comes up for a vote or not, to co-sponsor it. And it is that is a level of engagement with this bill that is just extraordinary. So now what we are doing is trying to figure out how do we get it to the floor. So your listeners might be thinking, my goodness, 325 people agree. Doesn't that seem like the most obvious bill for you to bring to the floor? And my answer to that would be, it should. It should seem like the most obvious bill. But the reality is that, you know, very few people get to choose what bills come to the floor. This is when I will be bipartisan in my critique. So, you know, I'm a Democrat, Garrett's a Republican. Last Congress, we had more than 300 or more than 200 co-sponsors. I believe we surpassed 300.
305.
305, thank you. And we couldn't get it to the floor when my party, the Democratic Party, was in charge. And now we are at 325, and the Republican Party, Garrett's party, is in charge, and we still haven't yet gotten it to the floor. And so in our discussions and in our sense of urgency, a little bit of the kind of fool me once, we thought we were there last Congress, and we are coming up on the end of Congress, right? So we, this current Congress, so this current House of Representatives is constituted through the end of December, which means we need to get this, those 325 co-sponsors matter through the end of December. So we need to bring it up for a vote. There's a thing called the 290 rule, which we tried to employ last Congress, where when you get more than 290 co-sponsors, you can force movement on a bill. The challenge of that is you can force movement of a bill to a committee where it might die or languish. Or we can utilize what is called a discharge petition. And a discharge petition is the path we've decided to go. And what that means is that any member of Congress, so you don't have to be in leadership, you know, the majority leader or the Speaker of the House are the folks who typically choose what bills come to the floor. And you don't have to be in the majority or the minority party. It's any member of Congress can file a discharge petition. And so Garrett and I are pursuing a discharge petition. What that means is you go through the procedural steps of saying, we want to petition for the discharge of this bill. And then you have to get people to sign your petition. There's some procedural steps to it. And the end result is we have taken the procedural steps. And as of September 10th, which coincidentally or conveniently is Congress's first week back after the August district time, we will begin having members sign that discharge petition. Now, the discharge petition means that we have to get what in a fully attended Congress to pass a bill, we need 218 votes. And so in order to get the discharge petition to work, we need 218 signatures. And when we get 218 signatures, we can push the bill to the floor. Regardless of what leadership might say, you know, again, this Congress is under Republican leadership, so regardless of what Speaker Johnson or Majority Leader Scalise say, regardless of what Minority Leader Jeffries may say, we would be able to push this bill to the floor, and then Garrett and I would actually control time on the floor, which not as the Committee of Jurisdiction, not as the chairs of those committees, we would be able to control time for the debate for our bill. And it's very exciting because we've already had 325 people go on the record saying they support this bill. And now we only, and I'll air quote only, need 218 people to sign the discharge petition. So what this means is Garrett and I are gonna do a lot of hustling. We've already got some great colleagues who intend to be quite helpful and supportive on this. Greg Landsman of Ohio, is a colleague who is super, super passionate about this legislation. Nikki Baczynski of Illinois is another one. And, you know, I end up sort of laundry listing. But, you know, we're going to be doing the aggressive work to make sure that, you know, any relationships we have across the aisle or certainly on the Democratic side of the aisle, you know, that we're making sure people know they have to sign, they need to get in line. You literally stand on the House floor and you stand in line and you literally sign a petition. And I know that, you know, on the Republican side of the aisle or with the, you know, strong relationships he has with some of my Democratic colleagues, that Garrett and his counterparts who are super passionate about this bill are able to get the number up to the 218 that we need in order for it to come for a vote. And this is where, before I end this little monologue, if I may, I would just want to thank FOP because you all have been extraordinary in your outreach. In your engagement, in your education. You know, at times it is one thing for me or for Garrett to tell our colleagues about the value of this bill and why it matters, but that's a little bit academic. That's a little bit within the frame of legislation. It is when FOP members or when firefighters or retired teachers or retired public servants of any type do the advocacy of saying, let me tell you about my experience. Let me tell you why, as a retired police officer, this is so unfair, and why I'm advocating for my fellow, you know, not just the folks who are retired now, but the people who are retired into the future, why I'm advocating for this system to change. That advocacy work has been monumental in making sure that people across Congress know that there's somebody impacted by the weapon GPO in literally every congressional district, and that's why our action is necessary.
So I'm curious. Last Congress, and thank you for those kind words. This has definitely been a journey where a number of us have been working together and coordinating, you know, at least once a month, sometimes often more than that, to make sure we got to this point. And, you know, last Congress we got to the 290, but we did it. You know, it took us 20 months to get there. It really didn't leave us a whole lot of time to get something through the House and then onto the Senate to get some kind of actionable timeline. But we had it. And then 2 days before we had a vote, the committee decided to pull it, get it off the calendar, and have a hearing on it. We've already had two hearings in the House, one in the Senate, but two in the House already. Under this new approach of the discharge petition, can committees basically run an end around on us?
It depends. The answer is it depends on how we write and draft the initial documents related to the construction of the discharge petition. So we did a tremendous amount of research on this to make sure that we were creating a discharge petition mechanism with the correct vocabulary and parameters so that we couldn't see that same sort of diversion. And the challenge with the 290 rule is explicit in the 290 rule is that it comes up for a vote or it goes to committee. And because we got at that 290 point and ultimately surpassed it so late, we were bumping up against the end of the fiscal year, and there were kind of these, you know, asterisks that allowed that sort of, and I'll call it gamesmanship, to occur. With the way that we've constructed the discharge petition, that should not be possible. Based on all of our discussions and work with the parliamentarian's office. Additionally, this is also where Congressman Graves, Garrett Graves, has done important work. Again, I mentioned last Congress, Democratic Party was in the majority, which means not just leadership, but also the chairs of the committees. This time around, it's a Republican majority, so Republican chairs of committees. And so Congressman Graves has done good work of engaging with the committee chairs, and so not to speak for his conversations with them, but they are aware that we are taking this path. Certainly they have had hearings, and which I appreciate, but we know the problem. Talking about it more in the halls of Congress isn't going to fix it. It's a vote on this bill that will fix it. They know this is coming, and we have formulated it in such a way that it should avoid those types of gamesmanship.
Yeah, you know, I had the opportunity. I was able to testify at one of the hearings and then provide written testimony for the other. But I also had a good deal of interaction with members of the Ways and Means Committee, and I'm very, very thankful that all of them recognize that this is an injustice and it's something that needs to be fixed. Their path to do so often varies some, but they all agree that it's just not fair to public employees. I guess the part that I find the most frustrating is that some of the members of Congress that I speak to, in one hand, says that you're being treated unfairly, and we are, you know, the system is set to steal money from public employees, and at the same time telling me that I need to find a way to find the funding to put back what is being stolen from us. And it just, there's something that just not, you know, like, our whole system is built on fairness. Yeah. You know, all of it. There's nothing fair about any of this. And I can understand people that are in the Social Security system that are not public employees saying, man, don't mess with my Social Security system. You know, that's just not fair. You're going to, you know, you do this and you're going to, you know, weaken my Social Security system. In reality, you're not really weakening it. You know, you ain't weakening it at all. If anything, you know, you might talk about if you're going to run out of money on a certain day, and you just might run out a few minutes earlier. That doesn't mean, I'm not saying we don't need to fix the Social Security system.
But
you're saying it shouldn't
be
on the backs of public employees.
And that's what I tell my colleagues, right? This, the way that we pay for this is these are Social Security dollars in our Social Security system. And we would, you know, for the retired police officer who is currently experiencing, you know, a loss of earned benefit because of WEP or GPO, we don't need to find a way to pay what is their earned benefit because it's in the Social Security system.
Exactly.
In fact, we're just actually holding back the earned benefit that should be going to them. And if that person had pursued a career in the private sector, they'd be getting that full amount.
Yeah.
And so when people talk about the long-term solvency of Social Security, like, I am so here for that conversation because we have to plan in advance for a time when, you know, Social Security might face real challenges paying out 100% of the earned benefits that people are expecting. But we don't punt that date a little bit further along on the backs of retired public servants, which is what we're doing.
Exactly.
And even if someone wanted to have that argument and say, oh, we need to buy ourselves a little bit of time and we've been doing it like this for 40 years, so why stop now? Then where's the conversation about building long-term solvency for Social Security?
Exactly.
Right? And the reality is people are just punting, negatively and unfairly impacting retired public servants, and then still not wanting to have the conversation about long-term solvency issues.
Right.
And so, you know, the idea that we would just sort of delay a wholly separate, different challenge by negatively and unfairly impacting retired public servants, I think it's just a lot of people missing the mark on what it is that we should be focused on.
Yeah, I want to get into what that next step is and what we need members to do, but I want to point something out, at least in law enforcement. It may affect fire to some extent. I'm not too sure about other public professions, but, you know, law enforcement officers are, you know, we've had a major challenge, and we will have it for probably a generation, and that is finding enough of the best and the brightest to step up at a rate we need in order to be able to sustain the staffing levels for public safety across this country. We've saw so many law enforcement officers leaving our profession, and we've created this big void. And so we're in a crisis mode across this country. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to fix. And let me tell you what Social Security windfall elimination government pension offset does. That doesn't apply any other, you know, we talk about it affecting public employees. Let me tell you what it does for law enforcement. We need people to step up and take the job of law enforcement. Now, traditionally, you'll end up with the younger people that will take the job. But the reality is they're not coming at a level we need. So what we need to do is we need to take employees, you know, workers that have a servant heart that say, you know what, I've worked in a private sector for a while, but I think I want to be a public servant. Well, here's the problem. When a public servant who's been in a Social Security system and paying into the system for a while, the day they raise their hand and take an oath to protect their community, they are giving away 60% of their Social Security. Tell me where that is fair.
It's not fair. And you use the public safety example with police officers and career transitioners, folks who go into police work. A place where this is really common is people who begin their career in the private sector and then choose to go into teaching.
Yes.
Right? That is a very, very common path that we see. And frankly, with the shortage, you know, not just of law enforcement officers, but of teachers.
Yeah.
We should be welcoming, encouraging, and working really hard to recruit and retain people into any type of public service, but particularly into law enforcement, particularly into the teaching profession. And, you know, the notion that making that switch might put them in a position where, like, they're negatively creating, impacts for their family, for their retirement, I mean, that's going to impede people's abilities or at least make them second guess. Because even if you are totally mission driven and this career transition might be the right one for you, you know, if you're a parent, if you have a spouse, if you've been planning for your retirement, the idea that what you've been planning for, you're going to reduce, you know, and substantially, potentially so, that has to be a part of people's calculus. And importantly, aside from the money, the disrespect that it conveys to public servants to say, you know, Congress can't get our act together to solve for the long-term solvency issues of Social Security, so we're going to continue to buy ourselves time on the back of retired public servants, right? It's sending the wrong message in addition to the actual real-life impacts that people face.
So let's wrap this up, and we need to talk about what we need people to do. I started off a little bit earlier talking about the problems we had last session, the last Congress, yeah. And that was not having enough time to be able to get this over the finish line. It took us so long to get to that point. We really are up against a wall here, because even if we're successful in the House, all right, which you know, all indications, the momentum is certainly in our direction. If we're able to get this past the House, it still needs to go to the Senate, and it still needs to go to the administration. It needs to go to the president's desk. So that doesn't happen overnight. Let's talk about why it is so important that each one of our members, just in law enforcement, firefighters, teachers, any public employees, needs to reach out to their members of Congress and tell them that we need them on the 10th, September 10th, not on September 11th or September 13th or the 22nd, It is important that we get this as quick as we can and get to 218 so that we could set the calendar. It is, what is it, 7 days? 7 days for a vote?
And so, it's legislative days, so that also takes longer.
Week and a half.
Yeah.
So a week and a half, we could potentially, in a month of September, have this completed and sent to the, because it's a finance bill, it has to originate out of the House, then the Senate can take it up. Senate, we have 62 co-sponsors, which suggests it's a filibuster-proof number. We will see. But ultimately, we're going to find out those who've been telling us all along that they stand with law enforcement, that they stand with public employees, both in the House and the Senate, have an opportunity to show us just how much they support us right now. So let's close it up by telling our members, those that are listening and watching our interview today, what do we need them to do?
We need them to call their member of Congress and tell their member of Congress that we need you too. Sign this discharge petition. September 10th, all day long, any point in time in the day, it will be available on the floor of the House. We need them to tell their member of Congress, please sign this discharge petition. We need to get to 218 quickly, because we need to wait those legislative days before it can come up for a vote. As soon as it comes up for a vote, it takes a little bit of processing time to send it over to the Senate. We need the Senate to act quickly so that it can go to the president's desk. Everyone knows this is an election year, and the kind of mechanics of the election year are the bit of this that impacts, because in an election year, our calendar is slightly different. We spend more time back home in the districts around the election day. And right. So we have to get this through in September so that we have plenty of time, or at least sufficient time, for it to go to the Senate, get their vote, and then go to the president's desk. The longer it takes to get to 218, the more challenges we create for ourselves in ultimately being able to get it to the Senate in time and to get it to the president's desk in time.
And just a point of clarification, the reason why, you know, we reached this number in 8 months, the 200, you know, the 290 rule. The reason why it took this long is because we were working with leadership in the House to try and to come to some resolution to it. It became obvious that long ways apart, and that's why we're a little bit later in this process, trying to find some reasonable solution to it. So
and the discharge petition, I'll use Garrett's words. You know, typically you try to bring things through committee. Typically you try to wait for the majority leader and the Speaker of the House to bring something for a vote. But really what the discharge petition says is it's the will of the people. And, you know, sometimes from a scheduling perspective, and I get it, we've got to do our appropriations bills, we've got to do a farm bill. There is a lot of legislation that needs time on the House floor. And so I understand completely why, you know, for the folks who are managing the calendar, they say, I don't think we have time for this Social Security fairness bill. But I would argue, and I think, not speaking for Garrett, but I think he'd agree, that the people who have been waiting and waiting and waiting to see these provisions taken away, they've waited long enough, and they don't have time to wait. Wow. And so that is why we are pursuing this discharge petition. It was certainly not our first course of action, but there's an example already. A Republican colleague from Florida moved forward with a bipartisan discharge petition that moved through the House, moved through the Senate, and was signed into law. So this certainly wouldn't be the first successful discharge petition of this Congress. It would be the second. And it's important for anyone calling a Republican office, making sure that those members know that Garrett Graves, Republican congressman from Louisiana, and I, Democratic congresswoman from Virginia, are doing this together, is an important element so that people know that this is not kind of a hyper-partisan action that, you know, the minority party might be taking. This is a bipartisan effort by a Democrat and a Republican to bring forth a bill that matters to constituents and members of Congress across the political spectrum.
Yeah, this is not a political issue, not at all. Yeah. This is a matter of fairness. It's as simple as that. It's a matter between right and wrong. So again, thank you very much for all your advocacy on this issue. Finally, I'm feeling like we're accomplishing something, and hopefully we can get this over the finish line as quick as possible. So to our viewers, if you're a member of the Fraternal Order of Police, go to our website. We'll put it up on a screen. We have it all easy process for you to contact your members of Congress. Just put in your zip code, and we'll take care of it. If you're not a member of Fraternal Order of Police and you're watching this and you want to help, reach out to your member of Congress. If they're a co-sponsor, thank them. Thank them for getting us to this point. But more importantly, tell them that now is the time, and most important, we need their support. We need to help. We need them to sign this petition on September 10th, not September 22nd or whatever. Time is of essence here. It is important that we get this done and get over the finish line. Congresswoman, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Representative Spanberger, thank you for your advocacy. I appreciate all that you do for our members in support of law enforcement and support of public employees.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you to everybody who's listening.
And thank you. And to our viewers and listeners back home, thank you for tuning in to the Blue View Podcast, where we talk about the issues that are so vitally important to the men and women who suit up and show up every single day and make a difference in the communities we serve. Thank you.
Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. To get the latest from the National FOP, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at GLFOP. And on Instagram at FOP National. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.